session number 30304.
The ice reconnaissance flights were onerous. Why was that?
Sorry.
You said the ice reconnaissance flights were onerous. Why was that?
Well, for one thing, they were about 10 hours long, which, I mean, it's quite comfortable in the Hudson, but it was going further north than one would go out of choice. We actually got as far north as 72 degrees north, well inside the Arctic Circle. During the winter in particular, when the ice reconnaissance, well, certainly in the late autumn or early spring, the ice reconnaissance was important, very important, because the Admiralty needed to know whether the Denmark Straits would take shipping or whether it would be sufficiently covered in ice to make that impossible. And also, of course, it was of prime importance in being patrolled by two medium-sized cruisers against the possibility of the voyage by the Tirpitz, which was in Norwegian waters, but no one wanted a repetition of what happened when the Bismarck got out. And obviously got into the Atlantic through the Denmark Straits and caused a lot of havoc. Of course, and the story is well known that it took about 5 or 6 days to find it once it got into the Atlantic, and it could have done a great deal of damage, as indeed the German battle cruisers had done. So that it was onerous in the sense that of all of the jobs which had to be done well, the ice reconnaissance was perhaps the most difficult to do the job properly, because the plotting of the ice is a very meticulous business. You are completely the pilot, I'm speaking as now, in the hands of the navigator. He is the one with the requisite charts, excuse me, and he directs the pilot as to the direction to take the aircraft so that he can get the fairest assessment of what ice there is and where it is. It's not an easy job, because you're trying to gauge the difference between Skodsa, which is sort of mashed up ice, and flat ice, even to the depth of it and that kind of thing. It is a tiring 10 hours altogether. And of course, because the important times of year for this to be done are in the early winter, late autumn, early winter, or early spring, the weather is at its worst. And so you have to hope you can get the job done and still be able to get back to landing. It's not like operating. It's the first thing I think you've got to realize when you go to a place like Iceland. And of course there are countless other places in which the RAF has operated. But what you want to know, particularly as a pilot, is where are the other airfields? Where are the ones I can go to? Where can I get to if I can't get into my home base. And of course, with Iceland, you've just got the one. Similarly, in Greenland, you've just got the one. So, I mean, I say one, there are two, or at least were at the time, and there was an emergency landing place at Hoshun, which is on the east side of Iceland, a considerable distance from either Reykjavik or Kaldadarnes. And there's one place in the north which is an emergency landing ground, but no facilities. And after all, there's no point in putting down somewhere unless you can get out again by some means or other. So just the one real returnable, you might say, landing ground, Reykjavik, in Iceland at the time. Kaldadarnes was an impossible place, really, in very bad weather because of the high land behind and so on. Anyway, let's get on with the ice reconnaissance. Aircraft T for Tommy, had an extra tank instead of the bombs in the bomb bay. There was an extra petrol storage there, which gave it the extra range needed. And I reckoned you could probably get about 12 hours in the air from that amount of fuel. It was the 16th of November 1942 when we were detailed to do the ice reconnaissance in this aircraft, and of course there were no bombs or depth charges, so not there was any need for them. We weren't out to try and do any damage anywhere. But it was usual to take a second pilot because of the, for one thing, it's always useful to have another pair of eyes on an occasion like that. So there were five of us in the aircraft instead of four. But it was essential in that particular period to do this ice reconnaissance because, for one thing, November's loss of shipping was the highest. November 1942 was the highest throughout the war, with 814,700 tons of shipping lost. And this was partly owing to both U-boats and the longer range aircraft, the Condors, which the Germans were using from bases in France and Norway. And whenever the smoke from the Tirpitz, the German super battleship in Norwegian fjords, was seen to be blowing smoke from her funnels, then there was panic in the Admiralty, and they didn't want that to get out and be able to use the passage down the Denmark Straits. There was, at that time also, because of this possibility that the Tirpitz might attempt it, if the Denmark Strait would offer a feasible passage for it, there was the fear of a devastating attack on the Allied convoys which were carrying Allied forces for the landing in North Africa, because they were coming from various points of the globe, so that on this occasion we were sent off with three other aircraft who were doing patrols, some of them to cover those. And as we were airborne about 0800 in the morning, it was rather, I still remember how we could chase our shadow down the runway, because the sun was behind us, and it was at a very low altitude. It just sort of appeared, so it was shining right down the aircraft, as it were, and the shadow of the aircraft was in front of us, and I remember chasing it along the runway as we were taking off to gain height. And then we went out by passing the core of Iceland. I'm sure all people who looked at a map of Iceland will recognize the northwest promontory, which is in the shape of a hand and even has a wrist to it with the connecting piece to the main island. And the height we were to fly varied, of course. Again, according to the navigator, he wanted it 50 feet, 100 feet, and then in trying to follow a lead of open water, which was perhaps the most important feature to report on, he would need a fair amount of height in order to get the likely distance of this open lead. Perhaps we'd have to go up to 1,500 feet, because some of the leads, well, some, one or two, of course, would lead out into the open ocean. But it was necessary, very necessary to know whether, in fact, that's what they did. So this was really the navigator's time for a good show, and it really was on his part. So just to give some idea of the kind of report and the plotting which he and I checked together once we'd completed that part of the job, he had to observe occasional small detached ice flows and some scodsa, that's the small broken ice, and note the longitude and latitude of it, and plotted fast ice, and to plot that on his chart, where there was drift ice, again plot it, running, as he had on that occasion, running it up to 71 10 north, 1940 west, and he saw it continuing northeastwards. There was one open lead running south from Scoresby Sound, 20 miles long, by, he estimated, 40 miles wide, consisting of one-tenth brash. In other words, it wasn't entirely open. That, to some interpreters back home, would probably mean that at this time of year, if the weather got even a little colder, that open lead would disappear, because this small brash, instead of melting, would accumulate, and so perhaps we wouldn't need another ice reconnaissance on that assumption for a week or a fortnight or whatever, according mostly to the weather. And then he found a second open lead which ran from Scoresby of 3/10 brash. Drift ice averaged about 8/10 of flows, and again having to estimate the size, which is not easy unless you can get right down, some of which were 20 feet and some as big as 200 feet in diameter. And brush, ice and sconcer was plotted in other areas as well. So it looked, as we said, I remember, so I can't remember which member of crew it was, but somebody said, well, any convoy waiting for the Russian run would have to, would find it tricky if they had to try and get through there. Anyway, we continued to fly northwards from 70 degrees north. There's now shore ice stretching as far as the eye could see. And as one sees, even in this rather polluted country, on a lovely day with a blue sky and a bit of snow around, it was an absolutely wonderful sight in the very, very clear air to find the rocky terrain on the left as we went up towards Scoresby Sound, the blue sky all around and this white covering over on the ground. We just fell to the temptation to explore further our very own blue and white wilderness. Passing Scoresby Sound, that's the bit that juts out of Greenland and the north, well, about the middle on the right. Along the edge of Jameson Land, the scene changed to a snow-dusted landscape of less severe rock formations, and the Greenland ice cap receded beyond our view. But, inspired by the strong rumour, so I was told by a member of the crew, that an English schoolmistress presided over the tiny classroom in the settlement, nestling in a protective saucer at Scoresby Sound, we decided we would fly the flag in the shape of RAF roundels. So we turned and set course for the sound. In summer, it was a 10-mile wide channel of silvery water, but now a silken sheen of ice as smooth as any seen by, let us say, Fenland skaters in the old days. We flew along it about 200 feet, came to a haphazard collection of buildings half hidden in the snow's embrace. The Danish flag could be seen at the top of a small mast, its rigging gently flapping in a zephyr breeze, and by the time we turned at the point furthest inland, where the inlet approached the ice cap, to fly past the settlement again, there was a Union Jack flying beside the Danish flag. The few inhabitants were waving, and a small group assembled round the flagpole responded to our flypast with the exuberant reactions of children. We made a couple of more or less low-level passes, took our leave with a dive and a roaring ascent into the blue, and then set course for home. Shortly afterwards, we passed down the coast near Cape Dalton, where a fringe of fearsome granite held back the ice cap. I noticed a sudden flurry in the snow beside a protruding rock. I realized I was looking at a polar bear. He turned as if to query this intrusion to his domain, and then acknowledged
the mighty spread of this giant bird and scurried away behind the rock, just as the other crew, I mean, responded to my exclamation. They suggested I'd been daydreaming, or worse. At 2,000 feet, on a southerly course towards the claw of Iceland, when Jackie Noble beckoned me as he finished writing out the radio message he'd received, what we got was, "To all aircraft, return to base immediately, weather closing in. Time of origin, 1100 hours. Caldadanis." Jackie acknowledged the signal and then said, "There's more. Imperative return to base before 1600 hours. We both burst into laughter at this impossible command. The time was 1500 and we were more than 300 miles from base. "Tell them we may be a little late," I said. "Get Jackie out of the turret, Jackie Hollis. You may need a break. You're going to be busy getting QDMs. And these QDMs are magnetic courses to steer as directed from a direction-finding ground radio station. And the one we were concerned with was at Caldadanis. We'd obviously not received the recall signals because at the time they were sent, we would be messing about here or there, down low level with the high level terrain behind us and not for the first time bouncing radio waves all over the place. And we didn't get the return signal. Anyway, as daylight rapidly waned and the overhead, the overcast thickened, we could see the reason for the recall, a mass of ugly weather coming up from the south. And before we began our homing on the QDMs in the cloud and drizzle, which now seemed to extend down to sea level, we just got a sight of the outermost finger of the claw. So at least that gave us a position, a positive position rather than dead reckoning, although the dead reckoning was pretty good. I was thankful that I'd taken the usual precaution of plotting safe bearings on my map, in this case, not only to the airfield at Calder, but also from the only direction-finding radio station, the one that will be sending our QDMs, which was at Reykjanes on the southwest tip of Iceland, about 50 miles from Reykjavik and 70 from Caldadanis. So once we were well clear of the land with the safety of the sea invisible beneath us, I asked Smithy to place himself between Jackie at the radio and myself so that he could pass the QDM bearings to me immediately. And then as I checked or adjusted the course, he could compare them with the safe bearings on the map and finally hand them down to the navigator so that he could add distance to the plot. I remember thinking our return now depended on three things. The skill of the operator at the ground station on his sensitive use of the direction-finding antenna. The perseverance and patience of Jackie in his constant request for bearings and on myself. The magnetic compass had to be used with a degree of caution in this part of the world because the magnetic pole, being in northern Canada, hundreds of miles from the true North Pole, and that had to be borne in mind wherever you were, in fact. It was therefore usual to keep to a course on the gyro compass in the blind flying panel, and on this occasion I needed to keep to a zero setting once we were on a safe QDM bearing. To give us a better idea of what the pressure was likely to be at sea level, for although we checked this during the last minutes of daylight, the rapid change in the weather was evidence, of course, of a rapid change in pressure. About every 30 minutes, following any necessary resetting of the altimeter, we slowly descended through the gloom, and about 100 feet reduced speed to 100 knots, so that the landing lights, we could switch them on, still cautiously descending in the hope of catching a glimpse of the sea, by that means discovering if the clouds had a base other than resting on it. With Smithy checking the barometric setting, as I strained my eyes ahead, right hand ready on the throttles, we felt for the base of the cloud. On only one of these descents did we catch the glimpse of the sea we were looking for, as the pale reflection of the landing lights from the mist suddenly became a brief silvery glow. As we roared up and away from it, I knew I had a decision to make. If the cloud and fog were on the deck, we wouldn't get into Reykjavik, and certainly not into Kaldidanus. We had no diversionary airfields within reach, such as would have been available in these circumstances in UK, thank the Lord. Furthermore, an incorrect blind approach to either Reykjavik or Kaldidanus might quickly lead to trouble with the higher land beyond. I'd known too many fatal crashes from trying to reach an objective from an uncertain position under low cloud, so I thought, well, we would have a much better chance of survival if we reach the radio DF station at Reykjanes. We would know immediately that we passed it when the QDM bearing was 180 degrees from the previous one. We would also know that we passed over hospitable land and were heading out to sea again. So, well, I would then make a 180-degree climbing turn to port to take us back overland at a respectable height. The crew would have to leave goodbye by parachute. I would quickly point the aircraft back towards the sea, set the automatic pilot at a slow rate of descent. God bless the Hudson, and then follow the others. We might even land close enough to the DF station to pop in and congratulate the operator on a good night's work. I didn't see any point in sharing this plan with the others as yet, as minds were on other matters.